Welcome to another episode of 30 Minutes in the New Testament. 30 Minutes in the New Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. Go over to 1517.org/podcast and check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, click on that Here We Still Stand banner so you can hang out with us virtually. Going virtual to the world, the Here We Still Stand conference in your living room while you're in your pajamas, where you're binging a conference like you're like a good show on Netflix. That's what you're going to do. You can sit there, eat junk food. You can Mountain Dew and Cheetos in a beanbag watching the Here We Still Stand conference. You can do it all. It's going to be a great time.
That is my idea of a great time.
That's it.
Mountain Dew, Cheetos, beanbag,
gospel.
Great theology.
Yeah, that's it, man. Hey, sign up so you can get that that email that'll give you the link at the appropriate time. It's free. It doesn't actually cost you anything. Put in the time. If you got to go to work, put in the time now. Be like, hey, Friday, October 16th. I'm going to be at home at a conference in my living room. That's where I'm going to be. So Friday, Saturday, that's when it's happening, the 16th and 17th of October. Love to have you participate. Eric, what's going on, man?
I'm away at a little retreat this week with my family. Besides that, not too much. Been a little bit more relaxing this week, but what's going on with you?
You know, man, I'm just grinding out on this Here We Still Stand stuff, trying to make it great for the people. So
you're not sitting in your beanbag drinking Mountain Dew and eating Cheetos?
No, I don't get to do that. I have to actually try to make it to where you can do that, dear listener. So that's what we're working on.
Yeah. It's what it takes to present the Netflix of Christian conferences.
That's it, dude. So it's gonna be a good time. Looking forward to it. We're trying to talk, speaking of food.
Yeah,
we're gonna talk about some food in this text. About the kind of food that you better not eat in your beanbag watching Here We Still Stand.
Yeah, food offered to idols. I suppose one could offer Cheetos to idols. I don't know that the idol would find it particularly persuasive in their act of worship. But this, of course, was an issue that was still very prominent in the Corinthian culture, because you had any number of pagan temples, any number of different religions, and it was very common that, of course, one of the ways that you got the idol to try and do something for you was to, you know, offer food to him. You sacrifice something or you put something on the altar. And the hope was that that idol would go, okay, that's good enough food. I'll go ahead and grant you your wish, grant you your prayer request or whatnot. And so Paul is apparently, in a letter that was sent to him, is asked to address this issue, very specifically how Christians should interact with food that has been offered to idols and yet is being offered to them. So we pick it up at chapter 8, verse 1. It says, "Now concerning food offered to idols, we know that, quote, all of us possess knowledge," unquote. All of us possess knowledge. Now, that is a quote, and that the reason he's using that quote is because it was probably used as a way to frame the question to him. You know, since we have knowledge of what's going on with this idolatry, what should we do about it? How should we address it? He says, "This knowledge," quote unquote, "puffs up, but love builds up."
Yeah, it seems like what he's saying is that in this letter, they're like, look, we all know that food sacrificed to idols, whatever. Like, we know that we're free. We all know this. Dude, we just eat whatever we want, right?
Yeah.
And he's saying, yeah, this knowledge that you're talking about sounds a little arrogant.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. And so he contrasts having this kind of knowledge with love. And of course, he uses this famous phrase, knowledge puffs up. And Dan, I mean, you and I have been around the block a little bit. I mean, we're not that old, but we've seen some things. And I mean, I've definitely been in situations where knowledge has puffed up, whether it's puffed me up or whether it puffs up somebody else. I mean, you know, if you get somebody that's started to study theology a little bit, maybe, you know, first year seminary student, and they start to be introduced to concepts and ideas that they've never been introduced to before, it doesn't take long sometimes for people to be puffed up by such knowledge.
Right.
And yet Paul here says, like, well, yeah, knowledge has its place. I mean, he doesn't diminish the importance of knowing something. But love is vastly more important.
Yeah. Yeah. Love is greater than knowledge. This is his argument for sure.
Mm-hmm. So he says, if anyone imagines that he knows something,
I love that he says this. Okay. If anyone imagines that he knows something,
Yeah, if anyone imagines that he knows something, he does not yet know as he ought to know. This is, I mean, if I can just say it the way that sort of you might hear it in the common vernacular, the older I get, the less I know.
Yes. If anyone has this delusion that he knows things, he doesn't know anything the way he ought to know it. That is the idea here, that you think that you have exhausted the knowledge on a topic. That just means that you know very little of this thing.
That's right. That's exactly right. Instead, what's really important is verse 3. But if anyone loves God, he is known by God. So the knowledge that you really want is not so much your own head knowledge, but it is actually God's knowledge of you.
Yep.
That God knows you, and even knowing you, loves you. That's vastly more important than sort of information storage in your brain.
Yeah.
I mean, and again, not diminishing the importance of knowledge. Paul is not doing that at all. Obviously, Paul is a wise man and knows a lot. But that shouldn't be the emphasis. The emphasis should be on being loved by God and known by God as being your primary identity.
Yeah. And now he's going to move into the thing that they think they know.
Yes, exactly. So verse 4, therefore, as to the eating of food offered to idols, we know that an idol has no real existence.
Now that's
and that
quote.
There is no God but one. Yes. So there's two quotes here. An idol has no real existence, quote, and, quote, there is no God but one. So those are probably things directly written to Paul by the Corinthian church. Two statements. We know that the idol has no real existence and that there is no God but one. He affirms that. For although there may be so-called gods in heaven or on earth, as indeed there are many, quote, gods and many, quote, lords, yet for us there is one God, the Father, from whom all are all things and for whom we exist, and one Lord, Jesus Christ, through whom are all things and through whom we exist. So there's a interesting juxtaposition of language here, Dan, as he's talking about the truth of that statement, that all things are from God, and for whom we exist, all things are through Jesus Christ and through whom we exist.
Yeah.
So there's the from and there's the through, and there's a distinction there to be made. Sort of, you know, it reminds me of God creating the world through the Word.
Right.
There's, you know, the instrument through that he creates through is the Word, and we find out later, of course, according to John's Gospel, that the Word is God, is indeed God the Son.
Yeah, well, this is what's true about God, is that he works through things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, God likes to use means. This is all throughout the Scriptures. And so verse 7, however, not all possess this knowledge. What knowledge? The knowledge that he's just talked about who the true God is and his son, Jesus Christ.
Yeah, so this idea that he's saying we all know, he's saying, well, actually, you don't all know.
Yes, that's right.
And certainly a new convert, you assume that this is early in the church and there are new converts coming in all the time. They definitely don't know.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And so he says, however, not all possess this knowledge, but some, through former association with idols, eat food as really offered to an idol, and their conscience being weak is defiled. So in other words, what he's saying is that there's some that don't know, they're not settled on who the true God is, or they're still like sort of figuring all this stuff out, and that when they are offered food that has been offered to an idol, they eat it thinking that it actually is connected to that idol, that the idol is maybe blessing it, that the idol is real. Like they, so they actually are eating, and so they're doing something. It would be like they're doing it as an act of worship when they eat this food. That's what Paul is beginning to counteract. Like some people don't know that there's no such thing as idols, and they really think when they eat this food that they're actually committing an act of worship to this idol.
Yeah, so what Paul is concerned about here is the conscience of another person. So in the letter, they're like, look, can't we just, like, let's just inform everyone that this is fine and then just, let's just get on with it. But Paul would say that the more loving thing to do, and of course love is the more important thing than what you know, is that you would be concerned about the conscience of other people, even if the thing that is bothering their conscience is bothering them because they don't quite understand something yet. But there's still no reason to have somebody to do something as insignificant as eating certain food or making somebody else feel like they have to eat that food. That is not worth doing if that person then goes home and they have this tormented conscience about it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. And you know, so Paul will, on the one hand, like he's going, he starts off by saying, like, we need to be careful about our brother's conscience here. On the other hand, he does acknowledge sort of the truth behind why they're thinking what they are. He says in verse 8, food will not commend us to God. We are no worse off if we do not eat, no better off if we do. So his point is, technically you're right. Like, it's just food. It doesn't matter where it came from. It's it doesn't have any particular power because it may have been, you know, offered up to an idol or whatnot, or it's leftover meat from their sacrifice or whatever it is. You're right. That doesn't, you know, there isn't, because there's no idol, it doesn't have any power. That's true. But verse 9, take care that this right of yours does not somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. That's the idea that Paul is really getting to. If you want to get to the hub of what this passage is about, it's about using your freedom in a way that takes into account those around you that might be weaker in the faith, and not just flaunting your freedom in a way that could hurt them.
Yeah, and his argument is that freedom should be exercised in love.
Mm-hmm.
And that real freedom involves being free enough to not do something for the sake of your brother, as well as being able to do something because you're free. In other words, if you have to do this thing, you're like, I'm free and I'm doing this thing. Mm-hmm. Even though it will offend this person and it'll bother this other person's conscience, and I'm free, so I'm going to do it. It's not only is it a bad use of freedom, it's not actual freedom, because if you were really free, you don't have to do that.
Yeah. 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 Again, this gets back to something that we addressed the last time when we were going through chapter 7, which is, you know, Luther's statement in the Freedom of the Christian, you know, in which he says the Christian is a perfectly free Lord of all, subject to none. And yet at the same time, right after that, the sort of counter thesis of a Christian is a wonderfully dutiful servant to all and is subject to all. And so, you know, when you put those together, it sort of sounds contradictory, you know. But Luther's point is, in regard to your relationship with God, it is true. Like, nothing you do is going to hinder your status before God, because that's all wrapped up by the work of Jesus Christ on your behalf. True. But you still are a servant to everyone around you. And part of the way that you can serve your neighbor is by taking into account those things that might make them stumble, and withholding on something that you might indeed be free to do yourself.
Yep.
And so, you know, like, you can think of modern examples of this all the time, you know, whether, you know, if you're around somebody, you know, let's take alcohol, for example, and somebody is really trying to, you know, quit drinking, and you're like, hey, man, I'm free, you know, and so you pop open a beer. And you know that there's a very good chance that that person is then going to be really tempted to, you know, go ahead and open up a beer too. Well, you might want to hold off on doing that. Yeah, are you free to drink that beer? Sure, you're free. But for the sake of your brother who's standing next to you, it might be a good thing for you just to withhold.
Yeah, you're free to drink it. You're also free not to.
That's right. And this involves a very discerning mind, you know, and a very sensitive mind. It's love. It's taking into account what is good for your neighbor.
Yeah.
And caring about your neighbor enough to do that. So he says, verse 10, as an example, for if anyone sees you who have knowledge eating in an idol's temple, will he not be encouraged if his conscience is weak to eat food offered to idols? And so by your knowledge, this weak person is destroyed, the brother for whom Christ died. Thus sinning against your brothers and wounding their conscience when it is weak, you sin against Christ. Therefore, if food makes my brother stumble, I will never eat meat lest I make my brother stumble. Now, important qualifier here, Paul is not saying, therefore, I am vegan. Right. That's not his point here. And he's not saying that he would never eat meat again. His point is that if it's going to cause my brother to stumble, I'm free enough that I don't have to do it around them. I can withhold until, and then, you know, if I want to feast on, steakums offered up to the goddess Diana later, well, then have at it. Enjoy your steakum.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, politics is freedom. This is how free Paul is. If I end up in a situation where I am permanently around people whom me eating meat will offend, well, I just won't ever eat it again. And now you'd be like, I don't know, man. That sounds like a pretty hard law. No, yeah. He's just saying that's how free I am. Like, I don't have mm-hmm. to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not in bondage to this.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly his point here. And that's what he's urging them to think about. So they want to make it an argument, it seems anyway, from the context that says, hey, since we know that this food offered to idols is nothing, it's no big deal, why don't we just, enjoy all the food we want offered to idols or whatnot? And Paul's saying, well, take into account where your brother's at. Care about him enough to do that.
Yep.
So now continuing on with this discussion of freedom, we enter into chapter 9. Am I not free? Am I not an apostle? Have I not seen Jesus our Lord? Are not you my workmanship in the Lord? If to others I am not an apostle, at least I am to you, for you are the seal of my apostleship in the Lord. This is my defense to those who would examine me. Do we not have the right to eat and drink? Do we not have the right to take along a believing wife, as do the other apostles and the brothers of the Lord and Cephas? Or is it only Barnabas and I who have no right to refrain from working for a living? Who serves as a soldier at his own expense? Who plants a vineyard without eating any of its fruit? Or who tends a flock without getting some of the milk? Now, I guess we should break in here, Dan, and just explain sort of what Paul is talking about here. Paul is now moving from your freedom to eat food or to abstain from food, offered to idols, etc. And now he's moving into a discussion of his rights as an apostle. Like, he's free as an apostle. He can choose to do any number of things. Here in this case, he's talking about two specific examples. One, being married. He's free to be married if he wanted to be. I mean, that relates back to chapter 7 and a bit of chapter 6. Just like Cephas is, I mean, Peter was married. The other thing he brings up is the freedom to earn a living from his ministry. Both of those things he is free to do.
Right.
But as we go on, we'll see he chooses not to. Do I say these things on human authority? That's a rhetorical question. No, he's not saying these things on human authority. Does not the law say the same? For it is written in the law of Moses, you shall not muzzle an ox when it treads out the grain. Is it for oxen that God is concerned? Does he not certainly speak for our sake? It was written for our sake because the plowman should plow in hope that, and the thresher thresh in hope of sharing in the crop. If we have sown spiritual things among you, is it too much if we reap material things from you? If others share this rightful claim on you, do not we even more? So Paul's making the argument he has the right to ask the churches that he serves to provide for his living. Just right. Like a farmer would expect that when they're plowing out in the field that they get some of the crop, a preacher, an apostle, somebody who's bringing the message and sowing these spiritual seeds has every justification to hope that they would be compensated for it. That's really his point here.
Yeah, and he will say that the only reason that they have not made use of that right is that they don't want to put an obstacle in front of people. They want to obscure the gospel. Now, obviously, people are funding Paul. I mean, he has to live. But this is all done through without any compulsion or anything like this. He's not demanding mm-hmm. any sort of wage. The idea is that he doesn't want the accusation to have any legs that would say, these guys are going around from like place to place preaching this message, but they're also demanding that you pay them to preach the message. Like, this seems like just, this is economically motivated. That's why, this is why they're doing this.
And I mean, is there good reason that people would have that as a stumbling block throughout the church's history?
Well, no one's ever done this before, Eric.
I mean, you know, we know it all too well that there are people that have, you know, taken what they claim is the message of Christianity and used it to, you know, get extremely wealthy.
When?
And
who?
There's a few examples.
Where?
On the TV a little bit, but and even that, like someone being paid, or a pastor, you know, making you know, a decent living or a good living, it's not inherently condemnable. It's really not. What Paul's point is here is these people are that the reason they're not choosing to do that is because they realize that can easily be used as an excuse to ignore their message. And he doesn't want anything to get in the way of the message. Now, again, he says it's okay for others to do that. So it's not an issue of right or wrong. It's an issue of wisdom for how you will reach the particular mission field that you're in. And so there are people that might choose to do that today. There are people that might choose, like, I'm not going to take a salary because I just think that I'm in too much of a skeptical culture, that they will see it as a money-making scheme, and I don't ever want to be accused of that.
Yeah.
That's what Paul has essentially decided to do. Paul and Barnabas both at this point. Peter did not do that. Peter did make his living from the gospel, it appears, and other people did too. And so both things are fine. It's a matter of how one wants to use their freedom. That's the idea Paul's getting to. So he says in verse 12, "Nevertheless, we have not made use of this right, but we endure anything rather than put an obstacle in the way of the gospel of Christ. Do you not know that those who are employed in the temple service get their food from the temple, and those who serve at the altar share in the sacrificial offerings? In the same way, the Lord commanded that those who proclaim the gospel should get their living by the gospel. But I have made no use of any of these rights, nor am I writing these things to secure any such provision. For I would rather die than have anyone deprive me of my ground for boasting. For if I preach the gospel, that gives me no ground for boasting, for necessity is laid upon me. Woe to me if I do not preach the gospel. For if I do this of my own will, I have a reward. But if not of my own will, I am still entrusted with a stewardship. What then is my reward? That in my preaching I may present the gospel free of charge, so as not to make full use of my right in the gospel."
Yeah, so first he just to clarify for the listener, so he goes Old Testament on it here, where he says, look, I mean, like the priests, you know, they ate from the sacrifices, which of course is true in the Old Testament. So all the people that worked, the Levites, the people that worked in the temple, the way that this was structured is that the 12 tribes, and they're divided up, but the Levites, they don't have their own land. They're serving in the temples, and everybody else is supporting basically the Levites to do the Levitical priest work, right? And so they would be able to eat from the offerings, and they have lodging provided for them, all this kind of stuff. So he goes Old Testament and said, look, God has always set it up this way, that those who are entrusted with the work of the Lord are taken care of by those whom they are working on their behalf. So he says, yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. It's always been that way. However, I'm not going to make use of that right because I, mm-hmm. I desire to be able to say that I am delivering the gospel free of charge. He's also the apostle kind of to the Gentiles, and this old, you know, if you roll into a Gentile city and be like, you know how the Levites are taken care of? It's kind of like that. That's not going to work great to your Gentile audience. They're not going to be like, well, I see what you're saying. You know, so Paul is going in and preaching this message of free grace and free forgiveness of sins to people who are not that, to non-Jews, to complete pagans. And he wants that message of free forgiveness to be free. So he thinks mm-hmm. this is important.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, when you look at the structure of his argument here, what he's really trying to say, he even uses the word, this is my ground for boasting. And of course, Paul is, you know, he's not one that's like, oh yeah, I'm looking to boast about myself. You know, I'm so great. That's not his point here. His point is that I want to be able to tell people that I'm not making anything from this. Like, I'm doing this because I care about you. And there's something really wonderful about that. There's something really refreshing about that. again, he acknowledges in this whole chapter, there's nothing wrong with someone that chooses to make use of this right. And so, you know, for pastors that do take a salary from their church or whatnot, there's no wrong things with that. But Paul's point here, especially as you mentioned, Dan, trying to minister to people that are completely separated from any knowledge of the old covenant, from any knowledge of God, that he wants to be able to go out there and just say, I'm here for you and for you only. And that's it's not about the money for me.
Yeah, well, also, Paul is not a local church pastor. We don't know how these churches are being set up. And then, of course, they're going to have pastors. And you would assume that then those pastors are being taken care of. But Paul is a different sort of guy. He's not planting a church and then staying in that church for the next 25 years. He is a traveling evangelist church planter. That's what he does. And so he is a different kind of guy. He is different than Peter. He is certainly different than the guys that will then be appointed to take up the role of pastor in those churches. You assume that they are dealing with this differently than he is.
Yeah. Well, especially if somebody is doing it as their full-time vocation and it's, you know, taking up all their time where they don't have the time to do another vocation in order to provide income, then you would expect that they would need the church to support their living.
Yep, exactly.
And so this is a very specific appeal that Paul is making for on behalf of himself. So yeah, this is why he goes on to say in quite a famous and maybe familiar passage to you, for though I am free from all, I have made myself a servant to all that I might win more of them. To the Jews, I became as a Jew in order to win Jews. To those under the law, I became as one under the law, though not being myself under the law, that I might win those under the law. To those outside the law, I became as one outside the law, not being outside the law of God, but under the law of Christ, that I might win those outside the law. To the weak, I became weak, that I might win the weak. I have become all things to all people, that by all means I might save some. I do it all for the sake of the gospel, that I may share with them in its blessings. It truly is one of my favorite passages, Dan, just as when I think about my calling as a pastor, and when I think about my calling especially, or think about how we sort of approach the world, you know, how we come to the world, our posture should be one similar to Paul's here, in which we're trying everything we can to not bring any stumbling block in any person's way. And so if that means that we have to, adjust what we do or the way we think or the way we talk or whatnot in order to have a hearing with people, this is really what missionaries have done from the very beginning of the church. If you look at missionaries going out to cultures that they are not from, you're going to see back in especially the old days, but still today, you're going to see them dressing like the people that they're ministering to. You're going to see them eating the food that of the people that they're ministering to. You're going to see successful missions missionaries do not show up saying, all right, this is how we're going to do it now. We're going to change everything in your culture. But no, they adopt many things of the culture that they can without sacrificing the central message of the gospel.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of in the context of food and that sort of stuff as well. I mean, this is as simple as when Paul's hanging out with Gentiles, he might be eating those baby back ribs. But when he goes, to go hang out with some Jews, he's not, packing a BLT. Like that's not that. So
he's not chomping away on the bacon in front of him. Like, hey, what do you think?
Yeah.
Free.
Well, yeah. No. He said, how is this helpful? Right. Yeah. So I become all things to all people. Right. Mm-hmm. And this is his argument. He is essentially saying that in his ministry, he has endeavored to remove as many obstacles as he can to the gospel. Right. So I don't want what I'm doing culturally to be offensive to you so that you can't hear what I'm going to say.
Yeah. And the way I think that this, as far as how it's directly applies to our lives today, I mean, think about how we use social media. Think about what we choose to take stands on. And are those things that we choose to take stands on, are those things that we choose to endorse or choose to put out there, are those things ultimately helping people to hear the gospel, or are those things that can easily be used as ways to avoid the gospel that is very central to who you are and to who we are as Christians? I think to have that kind of mentality in your mind when you're when you approach social media or when you approach conversation with anybody is a very helpful principle to keep in mind.
Yeah, Paul knows that the gospel is the only hill worth dying on, and that's the one that he says over and over again that he will die on. You know, Jesus had one hill that he died on, and Paul doesn't think he should have a whole lot more than that. So,
yeah. Amen.
And neither should we. And that is it, man. That is 30 minutes. Guys, register for the Here We Still Stand virtual conference so that you can hang out with us online. And Eric, I will see you next week.
Sounds good.